This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. William Cameron. Today is 2 July 2008. I am at the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Cameron is kind enough to join us from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Good morning, Mr. Cameron.
Good morning.
To begin this interview, Mr. Cameron, could you give me a little biographical information? When were you born and where?
22 November, 45, Boston, Massachusetts.
What were your parents' names?
William and Alma, A-L-M-A.
Very good. How many brothers and sisters did you have, Mr. Cameron?
Two brothers, two sisters.
Where were you in the progression?
First.
You were the eldest then, okay.
Yes.
Where did you go to school?
Medford High, graduated 1963.
1963. What sort of things did you like to do in high school? What were your strengths?
My strengths? Academics and sports.
What kind of academics especially?
Especially English and history.
Mm-hmm.
Hated math.
I can relate to that. What kind of sports were you interested in?
Hockey and baseball, and then they made us play soccer, too. I hated it.
How would you describe your childhood, Mr. Cameron?
A normal middle-class kid growing up in the Boston area.
Very good. So you graduated high school in 1963.
Uh-huh.
What did you hope to do once you graduated high school? Did you have any plans?
Coach.
I'm sorry?
Teach English and history and coach.
In the Massachusetts area, I guess?
Pardon me?
In the Medford, Massachusetts area?
Yes, in the Massachusetts area.
Very good. Now, when you graduated high school, how aware were you of what was going on in the United States, foreign policies, especially as it concerned Southeast Asia and Vietnam?
Very ignorant.
Okay.
But naturally, we were growing up with the ideals of Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But as far as Vietnam, no idea.
Now, being from Massachusetts and from the Boston area, what was your opinion as a young adult of John Kennedy?
Oh, he was an idol. Naturally, he was, you know, a Roman Catholic, and being brought up as a Roman Catholic and in those days a practicing good Catholic, you know, you believed God, the country, the whole stereotypical gamut. That was me.
Okay. Now, what did you do after high school? Did you enter college?
Yep.
Where did you start college?
BC.
At Boston College?
Yep.
Okay, very good. What did you, you were trying to follow the English history.
Yeah, exactly, liberal arts.
Liberal arts, and of course you plan on going into coaching. Were you able to finish your degree there?
Nope. I lasted 1 year. I took a year off, and I dutifully notified the Medford Draft Board, and in October I was drafted.
Why did you just go the 1 year?
Financial problems.
Oh, sure, sure. Now, you dutifully notified the draft board. That must have been an uncomfortable experience.
You have to, you know.
Sure, sure. That must
in
have been
those days, please. Yeah, I did.
So was it with a sense of dread that you notified them?
No, you know, it still didn't dawn on me that, you know, there was a war going on, and it was still early in the war. What was that, 64, I believe. Yeah, it had to be 64, because I was drafted in 65, in October of 65, yep.
Okay, so in 1964, mm-hmm. of course, the United States is still limited in its involvement
exactly.
in Vietnam. But then again, in 1965, in the spring of 1965, things begin to heat up in Vietnam. So were you following this with much interest, considering
no.
that you still were not following it?
No.
Okay. So in you get drafted in the fall of 1965 in
yes.
the U.S. Army. Tell me what's going through your mind as an 18, 19-year-old young man when you get your draft notice.
I just figured, okay, here I go, you know, you have to go, you know. Canada wasn't an option, put it that way.
Sure, sure.
And the father being, you know, the Navy veteran from World War II, the upbringing, and, you know, my mother saying the rosary bead when I'm going, but I just, you know, Fort Dix, here I come.
So I guess your place of basic training was at Fort Dix, New Jersey then?
Yes, it was.
Hey, explain to me how you fared in basic training.
Let's see. You do what you have to do. You follow your orders. You know, you just shut your mouth. You don't volunteer for anything, and you get along.
Was there any specific instances in basic training that stand out to you over any others?
Yeah, I showed up with short hair, and they went nuts, you know.
Now, why was that the case? Explain that to me.
Really? Oh, this is a riot. I went to, you know, you put on a pair of shirt and clothes, you go to basic, and they yank you off a bus, and then all of a sudden some DI comes running up to you and says, you know, screaming, yelling, the whole bit. And he says, you, how come you have short hair? I said, I've always had short hair all my life. So he says, prove it to me. Big mistake. Reach into my wallet, and I have a picture of myself with short hair. So, you know, the usual crap. Oh, look it, he loves himself. He carries his picture. So from that day on, I knew, okay, idiot, shut your mouth and just go along with the program. That was the only thing that stood out. Naturally, you learn how to fire a weapon, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, how to march, big deal, you know.
So it doesn't sound like it was a, or at least looking back on it, it doesn't sound like it was a massive change for you. It was nothing that was traumatic to you in any way, shape, or form.
No, I was in shape, you know.
Sure.
You know.
So at this time, did you, now this is still in 65, mm-hmm. again, before the buildup, did you have any inkling you may be sent to Vietnam or somewhere else?
Oh, yeah, from the first day you step off the bus.
Now, how did you know that?
Oh, they start screaming, you're going to Vietnam. I said, okay, let me start doing some reading now, a little research here. What's Vietnam, you know?
So they made it pretty clear to you early
on. Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, after after basic training, where did you go for advanced training?
I stayed at Fort, what do you call it, Fort Dix. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, they made me a truck mechanic.
Any particular reason why?
I to this day, that's why I'm doing all this research. How do they figure out what your MOS is? You know, they offered OCS to me and all that stuff, and I said, no, thank you. Two and out is what I want.
Sure. Now, why did they offer OCS?
I guess when you take all your exams and all that stuff, there was about four of us they pulled out, and the captain said, "You, whatever you do, you want to go to officers training school?" I said, nope.
Do you think your college background had anything to do with it?
Oh, did I ever hear about that? Yeah, once in basic, yeah. You know, until they knew they, you know, okay, college boy, do this, and, you know, boom, boom. Then they laid off after they knew you shut your mouth and you do what you're supposed to, you know.
Right, right. So you say you just wanted to do the two and out.
You got it.
And to be finished. There must have been, I would think, some temptation for officers candidate school,
nope.
Just based on nothing whatsoever.
No, God, believe me, no. Nope.
Well, why you seem to be very sure in that you did not want to enter any sort of a more permanent station in the military. Any reason why, particularly?
You know what? See, I could say now I know why, but back then when I was 19, you know, nah, I had half a brain. I said, let me go. This is some part of my life I got to do. I never thought people would be shooting at me and trying to blow me up, you know? I just figured, okay, I'm going to go over there. I probably figured I'd be a clerk or something like that, you know?
Right.
But then I got, but no, it's, I just, you know, I knew I had to do 2 years, Kyle, and that was it.
Sure.
Hopefully.
Well, take me through a typical day here at Fort Dix in advanced training.
At the Wheelville, what, for the mechanics?
Yes, yes.
Ah, it was marked difference from basic, because now all of a sudden they mention Vietnam, but they say you're going to be fixing trucks. And I'm saying to myself, what the hell am I doing here? Because I didn't know a wrench from a baseball bat, you know? But it was still, naturally, still regimented and oriented, but they weren't as, how can I say it? Trying to break it down and build you up again. They were trying to educate you, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Sure, sure. Now, what kind of training, and be as specific as you like here, did you receive here at the Wheel Vehicle Training?
I don't know. They taught me how to fix trucks and, you know. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I wasn't 100% into it. I said, this is a joke, you know. But I did what I had to do to pass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody passes anyway.
Sure.
And you just help the kids, you know, you shine your boots, and, you know, you go to formations, and you you know, you went to class, I believe it was like, it was almost like an 8-to-5 job.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, what, anything outstanding yet? No, I met some, you know, I made some friends, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, where did you go after advanced training?
Lovely Fort Benning, Georgia.
That must have been a change for a...
Yeah, it was. It wasn't bad, though, believe it or not, except for what they wanted me for an MOS. They wanted me to be a tank mechanic. And I'm saying, you people are crazy. No, but hey, this is what they want.
I think I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Go ahead.
Why did they choose you for tank mechanic?
That's the million-dollar question, Kyle. I would love to know. I have a vague, vague idea why, because when I left B.C., I went to work for, my uncle was like a parts foreman at an international harvester company,
mm-hmm.
and I worked in a parts department driving a truck, big deal, you know. But that's the only reason I can come up with why the military ever thought of me to go with, you know, to fix trucks and tanks.
How much different was the tank mechanic training
for you? Oh, that was beautiful. It was laid back, and they really wanted to instruct you. I thought Fort Benning was nice. Plus, it exposed me, actually, not to sound corny or anything, but to multiracial, to just a different form of living, and to booze.
So it sounds like it was pretty beneficial, pretty positive experience for you here.
I'd never knock it. No, I wouldn't. You know, the instructors were very nice. They weren't yelling and screaming at you, and the barracks you lived in was very nice and clean. I don't know if you know Fort Benning, but it was right at the jump towers there.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw those poor kids, you know, coming off the towers and coming up with their parachutes and all that happy stuff.
And probably feeling pretty lucky that you're in
tank training. Oh, yeah, like, you know, everybody's saying, I want to go to jump school. I says, not me. Not me.
How different was tank training from the wheeled vehicle training?
Bigger vehicles, much more intense, but as long as you know, you had the basic understandings on what to do, you know, what does a generator do, what is, you know, changing tracks do, you know, simple stuff like that, simple repairs, but they were more dedicated to your training. They really were. I give them credit for that.
Sure, sure. So it sounded like you did pretty well in your mechanics training.
Well, you know, I still, to this day, though, I will not touch a vehicle, but go ahead.
How long were you here at Fort Benning?
I believe 9 weeks.
9 weeks training there.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you going to do when your training was over? Did you still...
No idea.
Didn't know. Still didn't know. Mm-hmm. Did you have any inkling that Vietnam may have been the future?
Yeah, you know, I figured, okay, here I am. I'm going to go to some, you know, somewhere near... You know, my limited ability there was Saigon and all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they probably had me fixing Jeeps, whatever. But then again, when with tanks, I just, whoops, wait a minute. Now they got me fixing tanks. I might be closer to where they, you know, shoot at you. You know?
Right, right. All right, well, you finished there at Fort Bliss. When do you receive your orders for Vietnam?
3 days after we graduated.
What's going through your mind? You suspected it the entire time, but now it's happening.
Oh,
what's
going through your mind? Yeah, game time. It's real.
Yeah. Had you, you said you did a little research.
Yes,
to figure
what
a little
I
bit
do
more
is
on
I
Vietnam.
Love to read anyway, so, you know, I'd always, you know, grab the New York Times and see what they had to say, if I could find one on post, you know.
Sure.
And I'd hit a library and do them. Back in those days, it was tough. But, you know, I looked up where Vietnam, what it was, did a little reading backwards. You know, I went all the way. Now, see, I'm trying to figure, because I know I did a lot of research when I came out. But just basically what was going on is what I tried to educate myself on.
Okay. In that research, what were you finding as a 19, 20-year-old man?
I'm saying, okay, people are getting killed. I started changing as I read a little, because I was still a practicing Catholic in those days. And I found out that they had a little, shall we say, a little involvement in the development of Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
sure.
I said, wait a minute. My mind started saying, there's a little politics involved here, but not much, nothing crazy, you know what I mean? And I'm saying, okay, I think I'm saying, is this a civil war or not? And I'm saying, you know, what the hell are we doing there? But to this day, I said, no, I have to do it, you know. I was still brought up in the World War II ideals and Korea. You had to do what your country said for you.
Sure, sure.
And there was a little minute demonstrations. You'll see little clips like people at Harvard are demonstrating, but just little stuff. And I'm saying, this is new to me. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't earth-shattering yet.
So
put it this way, not bragging a little. I knew a little bit more than the common poor kid that was, you know, shall we say, in training with me. But it wasn't a big topic of discussion. You talk to, say, maybe a... now I'm getting into Fort Bliss. I would say at Georgia, they would just... Some instructors would say, brace yourself. You know, it isn't all roses and peaches, and you could be doing stuff under fire. But it wasn't like in basic in the 1st Advanced Infantry where they'd say, now you got to do this because, we're fighting for democracy and all this happy shit.
Right, right.
At Benning, they try to make it professional, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And, I just kept reading, Not that I spent, I'd say out of a week, I'd probably spend 3 or 4 hours doing reading toward that. I'd be more involved in the sports page. No, I'm not going to lie to you.
Sure.
But I still wanted to know what the hell I was getting into.
Sure. Now, as you watch American involvement in there,
yep.
as you're doing this research, as you watch it grow from the end of World War II to what it was becoming in 1965, what did you think of the general flow of American policy?
I thought it was all for the best. By the best, I mean at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
Here we're fighting communism, plain and simple.
Sure, sure.
But I started wavering a little in Benning. I really started wavering.
What was it that you were finding in your research that led you to waver?
Why are we going over there? Nobody was invaded. Mm-hmm. Why is the church involved? Why is, why at the time is Johnson trying to build up troops? For what reason, for what goal are we trying to achieve here?
All right. Now, at Fort Benning, apparently, then,
yeah.
you ran into individuals, most likely instructors, I would guess,
mm-hmm.
who had been to Vietnam. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of things were they telling? You say it's for real and it's more business-like, but what sort of image were they projecting to you about what was going on over there and your potential role in it?
Do your job as best you can, but do it with a wary eye and always protect the person with you.
Okay.
And the other thing, the negative part, though, that I was never really, to this day, now I understand why, but they would never refer to him as an Asian or an enemy. They'd always say a gook, and that's what really pissed me off.
Okay, why did it anger you?
Because I was, I grew up in a white middle-class society, You never even used the N-word. No. I had seen two blacks, I think, before I get into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Except in sports, really.
So, why do you think that the military referred to him in this way, rather
they
than...
Wanted, now, I don't know, I doubt I knew it at this time, but now, with all my... maturing, as I would say. I think they were trying to dehumanize an enemy, so
sure.
It would be easy for you to say, hey, this guy is bad. Take him out.
Right, right. You depersonalize them. It makes it easier to do
I
job,
believe, well, I know now that was their reason. Well, one of their reasons, I guess.
Sure. All right. Now, you have a little bit of time between when you get your orders to move out, and before you actually have to go to the West Coast, I guess probably Fort or out to Travis in California.
Oh yeah, we did. Well, they sent me from Benning to Fort Happiness, as I call it, Fort Bliss.
Oh, okay, you went to Fort Bliss first.
Yeah,
El Paso.
And it was a new battalion forming up.
Okay.
So what did I do? No, they didn't take the train. They flew me, and luckily I had two buddies that I had met from Massachusetts, and they were going the same place as me. So, we went home on leave, and then I believe 7 days later I was at Fort Bliss,
so,
and it was a horror show.
Yeah, I was going to say that for a good New England boy like yourself, moving out to El Paso, out to Fort Bliss, that must
have
been a change
Paso.
For you.
I just hated what the Army did there.
Okay.
Juarez, Mexico, everybody needs to mature in Juarez, Mexico, I was better. I was, one thing I have to say, too, about Georgia, too. I got one of my lifetime goals. I got to an Alabama football game. Yeah, that was one of my goals in life. I always wanted to see where Joe Namath played.
Oh, yeah, I bet
and
so.
And we did. There was a kid in our class that was from Birmingham. He got his tickets, and we took the trip up there, and I saw a, well, it was a practice game, a spring practice just before. And I got to see an Alabama game.
Yeah, that's a whole new religion in Alabama.
And I had always, I'm a big football fan anyway. Southeast Conference ranks supreme overall. But anyway, I got to see that. But anyway, getting back to Bliss, it was a circus. Nobody knew what they were doing. Nobody.
Explain that to me a little bit.
We get off a plane. It took us 2 days to finally get off, because when we got to Bliss, nobody knew who we were and what we were. Oh, yeah, you're that new battalion. Just sit here and wait. So we waited for 3 days. And some lieutenant came and picked us up in a deuce and a half. And he started, "You guys are going to Vietnam. We're a good dude. Boop, boop, boop." You know, the whole rigmarole. This kid was just out of OCS, too. I think he was like a year older than me.
So
and I said, okay, grin and bear it. They took us out there, and I saw this tank I had never seen in my life before.
Which tank was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, M42A1 Duster.
Okay, right, the Duster.
Yeah, and then there were these Quad 50s on the back of deuce and a halfs and searchlight jeeps.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is an experience. And then it was like going through basic all over again. But I was, believe it or not, I was lucky to the extent of, I think I was 20. Yeah, I must have been 20. Yeah, I was 20 at the time. And all these other kids were just out of basic. Just out of basic. So basically, I was a little privileged because I was a little older and had been in the Army, say, 4 months more than mostly everybody else. And then for the first 2 months, we were just forming up. Then they broke us down to batteries. And I had to go learn, naturally had to learn about this new tank that drove us nuts. They had taken it out of mothballs from the National Guard. And they trained us shooting down airplanes in the Nevada desert, the New Mexico desert.
So you were also training on weapons as well?
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just mechanical, okay.
Oh, you better believe it. If that tank breaks down and I'm in the middle of nowhere, I want to know how to drive it, shoot it, the whole bit.
Sure, sure. Well, what did you think about this? I would think as a 20-year-old, this would have been quite an experience, tooling around the
Not
desert
really.
Out there. Really?
No, I don't want to sound lackadaisical about it, but it was, okay, let's learn this if you're going to go somewhere. And I'm wondering, shooting down airplanes, what in the name of Christ? I knew there were no airplanes. But then they said, well, we may be guarding air bases. Okay, fine, that's nice. You go to Da Nang, there's a beautiful Air Force base. You go to Saigon, there's a nice Air Force base. I figured I was still safe.
Sure, sure. Now, you're training there at Fort Bliss.
Yeah.
And you're going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two drastically different, geographically, in terms of climate, everything. What do you think about this?
I think, now you'll get me rolling. I think the Army doesn't know what they're doing. And even at 20 years old, I said, what in the name of God? Why aren't they training us like everybody down in Fort Polk or something like that? But the Army, in its infinite wisdom, they said, no, you're going to shoot down airplanes. Not until our last day there did they teach us how to, break into herringbone formations and guard and convoys and that. Believe it or not, I had 1 day training on Vietnam.
See, I gather you weren't all that confident in the training you received for where you were going.
And believe it or not, we had two good officers. We had an excellent captain, who to this day I'd love to see again, and a lieutenant that had just come out of as an E5, and he said he was making it a lifetime career.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, gentlemen, just learn what you have to do because we're going to the real stuff. You'd say, Lieutenant Rowe, what the hell are they teaching us there for? He says, I don't know, just learn how to use this stuff.
What kind of weapons were you training on there?
Everything from an M14, we never saw an M16 till July in Vietnam, M50, M60, Nazi the 40-millimeter tanks, the hell else, a grenade launcher, stuff like that. But it really wasn't much. They geared I forget how long I was in Bliss, maybe 6, 7, 8 months. I don't know, but we didn't really get to any infantry-type tactics till like the week before we were going home to go on leave and then come back to get on the ship.
So you had leave for how long after Bliss?
14 days.
14 days, and you go back to back home to Massachusetts?
Yep.
What did you do, knowing that you're going to Vietnam?
Drank.
A lot, I would assume.
Yep. hadn't smoked, though.
What about your family and friends?
My mother was saying, you know, rosaries, novenas, praying. And, you know, my father just, you know, he just said, do what you have to go, you know. I said, Dad, I'm going. Don't worry about it, you know. Behave yourself. And then all my other buddies, actually all of them, they were all still in college. And the night before I went back, we had one hell of a... And my wife also, she was my girlfriend at the time.
Okay.
God bless her. She's been married to me for, what, Jesus, 40 years now. You know, she didn't go out with us the last night, but, you know, I spent some time with her. I played hockey when I was home. You know, just goof around, drink, and, you know, what every normal kid does, I guess.
Sure.
And it was funny, too, because I had to use a phony ID.
That doesn't hardly seem fair, does it?
Well, you know, that's why I chuckle, you know, when I think of some of the stupid laws, but hey, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, as a 20-year-old and knowing you're going to Vietnam, it sounds like you still weren't taking this as seriously.
No.
As maybe someone might have in 1968, 1969.
No. I knew there was a possibility of death, but you know, at 20 years old, I'm not dying.
Sure, you're invincible at 20.
You got it.
That's why we fight wars with 20-year-olds.
Oh, please. Exactly. Amen. That's why there's no more draft, too.
All right. After after your 14-day leave,
uh-huh.
I guess, did you fly back to California?
No, we went to Bliss. We went back to Bliss.
Okay.
And then they packed us all up for, I believe it was a couple of days, you know, just checking everything, making sure all the equipment was secure, making sure the tanks, you know, making sure the trucks were all set. And they flew us all out to, I believe it was Oakland. Then we went into Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little demonstrations there. But then they took us down to Oakland, and we boarded this old ship. Lovely USNS Geiger. Which, believe it or not, went to the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. And I happened to get on board it because we have a cottage down there. And I said, this ship looks familiar. And I read the history on it, and sure enough, it was the old ship that I had gone to Vietnam on. My kids thought that was a big, you know, hook.
You say there were some demonstrations there in Oakland. What kind of demonstrations?
Just signs, you know, stop the war. I distinctly remember, you know, the long-haired, quote, hippie college student, you know, here, stop the war, but nothing big, you know. It was just in the papers, as you read in the papers, you know, there were a lot of college demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
I believe New York had one at the time, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, okay, time for a nice boat ride.
Well, what did you think of these protests and the protesters at this time?
Didn't faze me in the least. Everybody, you know, that was just my outlook on life. Everybody has their own opinion.
Sure.
As long as there's no violence in it, go ahead, do your thing.
All right, now... When you left Bliss,
uh-huh.
Did you leave with the with the equipment you'd be taking with you?
Some of it went to Galveston. Some of it was on the Geiger with us.
Okay.
Actually, we had our duffel bags and our rifles and machine guns.
Right. Describe that trip to Vietnam.
Other than getting dysentery and turning 21 in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, it was uneventful. You know, play cards, do a lot of reading, watch movies, you know, go off the back of, do physical exercises on the back deck, and, you know, that was about it. Nothing outstanding. No, you know, they kept drilling in your head, you're going to Vietnam. But, well, I knew I was going to war, and that was it.
What were you and your comrades talking about on the trip over?
This sucks, the boat, you know.
Right.
The trip, let me see, what else? Talk about, well, one of my buddies that got married, and a lot of us went to the wedding. We talked about that. Got us through about 2 days. I remember we listened to a Michigan State Notre Dame game, that infamous tie. That stayed in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I had my 21-year-old day birthday. They made a little cake with a candy for it. And that was about it, seriously, you know. And then, you know, you do your PT. You can only do so much PT and fire your weapon so many times off the back deck mm-hmm. or the fantail or whatever the hell they call it. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
No talk about the reservations any of you may have had?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, I would guess so, yeah. Now that I'm, geez, I'm trying to think back then. Yeah, there was apprehension, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But, you know, nobody thought they were going to die.
Now, did you stop in Japan first, or was it straight into
Vietnam? One day in Okinawa.
Okinawa.
It was the worst day of my life, just about.
Explain that to me.
Oh, just the impoverished conditions and the beggars and the prostitutes. And it was awful, to be perfectly honest with you. It was my first, not my last, but my first rude awakening about what life is really like.
Can you provide any more detail on that? It sounds like that had quite an impact.
Well, it had an impact on me. Well, as soon as you get off the boat, naturally you're crazy. You want to go get drunk somewhere and, you know, do whatever.
Right.
But as soon as you get off the boat, there was beggars, and there was an acrid, stinky old urine smell as soon as you get off the boat. And then we went downtown in these little pedicabs and naturally hit the bars and walk around. Like a fool, I still went to church. I made a visit to church. I should say a fool because the Catholic Church and I don't get along anymore. But I still made my, you know, Rigney and I, my buddy went in. We made, you know, you always taught when you go somewhere, always hit the nearest Catholic Church and make your wish. So we did, you know, make everybody come back safe. And then we commenced to debauch the whole world. But it was just, you know, you see these shanty towns, and you go onto a military base that's sterile, and 2 feet off, you know, here's these shanty towns, and, you know, bar rooms, and it's just awful. It was awful. I had never, there was nothing like that in Boston. I mean, how far had I been? New York City? New York City was paradise compared to that.
Sure. Did it, was this in any way a foreshadowing moment of what you saw in Vietnam, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was, but I didn't know it at the time.
Sure, sure. Okay, you're one day in Okinawa.
Yes.
You're back on ship again?
Yeah, 2 kids never made it back. They deserted.
Is that right? Deserted in Okinawa?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, they didn't make the trip back.
Do you have any idea why they deserted?
Yeah, they weren't going.
Just because of the war itself?
Yep. They said, fuck the Kodama, because I knew one, fuck this, I ain't going back. I said, you crazy, man. Nope. I guess one of them turned himself in, and I don't know what happened to the kid I knew.
Both draftees?
Yeah. Oh, a whole battalion.
Okay.
From a whole battalion, except for the non-coms and the officers were draftees. And, believe it or not, all the mechanics, Rigney and I were the only draftees, because I guess everybody signs up to be a mechanic, you know. Oh, yeah, it was, because when I did my research, everybody that came in, and I pulled out all the, you know, the orders, the formation orders and all, everybody had U.S. Prefixes on their service numbers, their unwilling service. I didn't know what that meant till years later. I always thought it meant United States. Unwilling service. No, most of them, the only RAs, the only regular Army, Kyle, was, you know, your E6s. Oh, your E5s and above.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even some of the kids made E5s. Like, I know Eli made an E5. Some of them, you know. I mean, I could have made E5 just before I came home. But I said, nah, give it to the kids that are staying in the Army. I could care less.
Right.
But at that time, I was already an E4.
Okay, you were E4.
Yeah, I made E1 right away down just about in Fort Bliss. And just before we went, when I came back from my leave, before we went to Vietnam, there was orders, you know. They said, Billy, you're an E4. I said, get out of here. And yeah, because they had to make whatever, you know, the quotas are for so many E4s, so many E1s, and all that happy stuff.
Especially in the new battalion.
A year in service, and I had made an E4.
Yeah, certainly.
Which I guess is unheard of, but in those days, you know, hey, you're a new battalion, they got to fill the quotas or whatever they call it in the military job.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Took me a year to make E4. Whoopie doo.
So, other than this need for higher ranks in this new battalion. Do you think there's anything specific about you that led to your rapid rise, as it were?
Nah. I don't know. I want to say, yeah, it was good and all that, but I doubt it, knowing the Army the way I do now.
Mm. Well, you were a little bit older, had a little bit more time in, a little college.
Yeah, I was 21, whoopee.
Yeah. Okay, so you're leaving Okinawa.
Uh-huh.
Where are you headed next?
Right to the pond, right? I think it was a 2 or 3 day trip to Vietnam.
Okay, and where was your point of embarkation?
You're going to love this. Vang Tau. We were supposed to go to Quy Nhon, but they turned us around. For what reason, I don't know. And we landed in the port of Vang Tau, which I know now is a resort area, but I didn't know at that time. And we did it the old way, over the side of the ship, into the LST, and into the port. How appropriate, how World War II-ish.
Now, later on in the war, when so many soldiers are making their way to Vietnam, they step out of a plane, pressurized, largely sterile environment. They step out of a plane and open the doors to Vietnam. Yeah. You had some experience being in Okinawa and on this ship, but nonetheless, when you reach shore in Vietnam, what are your impressions?
Holy shit, plain and simple, because we could see a bombing raid going on in the distance, and I said, hey, this is for real. You know, and I remember turning to Rigney, God rest him, and he said, you know, hey, shit, this is the real thing. I said, yeah, I guess so. And it was hot. But, see, we were accustomed to the hot because of the trip over on the ship. And it was, like you say, I feel bad for those poor kids that had to get on those nice planes with the nice stewardess and then debark and then, you know, run into this happy shit. We were bonding, I guess, in a way, going over on the ship, which was good, but... Mm-hmm. As the war progressed, as you know, they just had to get bodies over there quickly.
Sure, sure. Yes, to a man, other individuals I speak with about this who left the plane said their first impression was they could not believe the heat and they could not believe the smell.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the smell wasn't bad in Vang Tau, I'm not going to lie to you, until they, you know, we get on a C-130 and then they drove us to Benoit where we were going to set up a base camp. And I said, ooh, that was nasty. But it was still beautiful, I'm not going to lie to you.
So you go from Vung Tau to Benoit?
Yeah.
Okay, how long were you there in Vung Tau?
Enough to get on, grab your gear, get on a C-130, and fly to some airport.
That same day, then?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're now in Benoit.
Yeah, and then we went to a place, Long Bin, but it was on the outskirts. It wasn't that big build-up area. It was like 2 miles to the east of that.
Okay.
It was just a field, and when we had to set up... No, they already... I'm lying to you. They already had this tent set up, but we had immediately start throwing sandbags.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are the brand-new battalion here, and I should get this on the record. What was the name, the number of that battalion?
It was called the 5th of the 2nd.
5th of the 2nd.
Defense Artillery.
Okay. Now, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're beginning to put the battalion actually together in country.
Well, we had already been together in the desert, you know.
Sure.
But, yeah, this is, you know, we had the, I remember the 11th, because they put us on a bus after Benoit and to go to this place. And I remember I'll never forget this, the 11th Armored Cav escorted us in a convoy to where we were going to set up our base camp, because we were right down the road from them.
What are your thoughts on having to be convoyed with these escorts?
It pissed me off because they wouldn't let us lock and load our weapons.
Really?
Yep. Yeah. But, needless to say, it was ready. We still had our M14s, which I love. They were ready to go. But, you know, you didn't have your ammo packs or anything. You had 2 magazines. That was it. So that's, 40 shots.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the 11th Cav would have been, I think,
yeah, they had been there 3 months, I think, before us.
Sure,
so
sure.
Experts.
Yeah, I assume it wouldn't take long to become an expert. Something like that. All right, what kind of daily routine are you going through as you're putting the battalion together there in country?
First week, all we did was fill sandbags and, you know, make the tents habitable.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, we'd go out on, quote, night patrol around there. But we still didn't have the tanks yet.
Mm-hmm. They're still on their way from the States, I assume.
Yes.
Okay. So you're going out on night patrols. Take me through a typical night patrol.
Shit yourself, number one. No lie. Well, not literally, but... And it's... You know, you just... You didn't venture more than, say, half a mile from the base camp, because there was a village right downtown that had a steeple that the bell always rang. And you just go out there and you sit and you listen, and they tell you try to sleep, but you go, ha-ha. And, you know, I guess it was just to acclimate you. It was probably a safe area. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm just saying it was probably like just training, but... You realize you're in country and, you know, anybody moves. You always, one good thing I have to say about our captain, there was always an officer with us, and there was at least 20 men on a patrol. The officers, on the whole, luckily Lieutenant Rowe stayed with us most of the time. He was a calming factor. But I'm not going to lie, you were nervous as hell.
Sure.
And, they did. Once you left the confines of that base camp, they let you lock and load then. But you had to, you know, to take it out of the chamber as soon as you came back. But, I swear to God, I lost 10 pounds every time I went out for the first couple of weeks.
What was the terrain like in this
flat
patrol? Flat.
Flat, beautiful, lush green in the day, nighttime, quiet as hell, no lights. You look around, everything's black, and all you hear is, you'd see in the distance, you'd see, like, I remember seeing Puff the Magic Dragon for the first time, and that was a sight to behold.
Must have been impressive.
And that was about it. You know, it was very nice. And the village was right to your right as soon as you come out. And you had to call for permission to fire if you fired. Luckily, we didn't fire.
What do you take with you on one of these night patrols, typically?
I took the M14. We took two M60s. Everybody had their M14 and two M79s. And radios, naturally.
Sure. You say there was a village nearby. Did you have any contact with the Vietnamese in the village?
Not at that time, no.
Okay. Did they encourage you, superiors encourage you to not have contact?
Exactly.
Okay. All right, very good. Well, how many of these night patrols do you think you participated in?
Let's see. It's December now. Around Christmas. Probably about three.
Three. Okay. Do you feel that you're becoming more and more prepared for what you were to face?
Oh, yeah. You're in a different mode now.
Okay.
At least I was.
All right. Explain that to me. What's going through your mind? You say different mode.
This is for real. This isn't games anymore. This isn't Fort Benning, Georgia. This isn't basic training. You know, learn what you do, but really learn that weapon. Take care of your weapon, and people are out there to kill you. And you may have to kill somebody.
What about your tactics? I mean, you mentioned the understanding this mentally.
Believe it or not, we all went out single file, just like you see in the movies. Single file, and you just set up in a little semicircular or a half circle perimeter. You lay out your claymores. This is how they taught. This is stuff they had never taught us. This is why I think now that I think back, it was training. You lay out your claymores. You get your field of fires down, and you just sit there.
Now, you've got to sleep out there.
You're supposed to.
You're supposed to sleep out there.
Yeah.
Give me a little bit of what it's like to be out there at night.
You can't smoke. That's the, believe it or not, that was what pissed us all off. And, forget that sleep, smoking under a poncho. Forget it. No booze. You're completely 100% alert. You're very edgy. This is in the beginning. You're very, very edgy. And you're always checking your weapon. At least I knew I was. Because I remember the first night out, Rig and I had trouble with the with M50. It wouldn't, we couldn't get the breech to close. And you're just nervous as hell.
So you're going to curl up in a nice soft spot on the ground?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, real nice soft spot. Nice and damp. And you come back soaking wet.
Sure. Mosquitoes, ants, anything like that?
Red ants.
Red ants.
But not at this particular point. No. That's why, now that I think of you, I think it was more of a training area. But it wasn't that bad. There was a rubber plantation to the right, but they wouldn't let us in that. It was like, I want to say a field. Like, if you get down to Cape Cod and you see the cranberry bogs,
mm-hmm.
basically that's it.
All right. You're going through this new kind of training, as you, it seems like that's probably what you're going
now through. That I think of it, yeah, because you're on the job training.
So you did this, and this is December of, December of what, 1960?
This is 60, it's still 66.
Okay. You've got Christmas coming up.
Yep.
What do you do there?
Believe it or not, we had a tag football game between the officers and the enlisted men. And I get everybody to do, well, the captain was good. He says, we got to do something. He dressed up as Santa Claus, and then a couple of us dressed up as elves. And we sang Christmas carols, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never forget that Christmas.
Well, you're going to spend the New Year's in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Does this have any sort of effect on your 21-year-old self?
No. I just, you know, I'm saying in October, my ass is back in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way, believe it or not, I was looking at it.
Is that something you kept in mind throughout your tour?
Oh, definitely throughout the tour. In fact, we'll get into that later, but Lieutenant Rowe got me out early to go back to college.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, we'll definitely want to get into that later on.
Yeah.
All right. I assume that while you're doing this, while you're spending the time here going out on night patrols in the base and doing the things to make the days pass, I assume that the rest of the material is slowly coming in, building up to get you to your full complement. Is that right?
Yeah, I think January, I'd say January 3rd or something, we went down to Newport to pick it up, a port in Saigon.
Okay. Well, when do you go out on your first mission? As part of the
before that, we went on a fire mission.
Take me on that fire mission.
Just test the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
It was just before Cedar Falls, so you're talking January, the beginning of January. Did I get nailed at 10? Yeah.
What were you trying to do in this fire mission?
Make sure the tanks work.
What sort of things were you doing?
Well, I never got to see it because one of the tanks had flipped over. And, you know, we were the last vehicle in the convoy, so naturally we stayed there trying to rescue the guys.
Mm-hmm.
But to no avail.
Okay, so you have everything in, or essentially everything in here in January. You're making these test runs, as it were, on this mission. And, of course, Cedar Falls begins later in January.
January 8th.
8th, I believe it is. Yes, that's right. Now, let's slow down and take a larger look at Cedar Falls. What was the purpose of Operation Cedar Falls?
To us, we were going to go out and support the 1st Infantry and the 11th Armored Cav, and they were taking some village. At the time, I didn't know it, but now it was Ben Suck.
Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of taking this village?
I guess it was supposedly, they told us they were going to clear out the VC.
Now, obviously, the VC were very, very active in this region.
Oh, yes.
Of course. What sort of contact had you, and you personally didn't have it, but your outfit or the 11th Cav or those who you were around, what were they telling you about what was taking place here?
Keep your head down. And it was funny because our tanks were wide open, but... See, we were a novelty, too, because whenever the infantry saw us, or even the tanks that we supported, they loved us because you had four quad 50s mounted on a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And the 40-millimeter tank, you put out like 200 rounds a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But you're standing in the open while you're, while you're loading the foolish thing.
Sure. Okay, when Cedar Falls begins, what are you in particular doing?
I was riding in the captain's Jeep, and we were, fixing any one tank that broke down on the 10th of January. So I took another tank out to fix it, and lo and behold, I got blown up.
You were hit. Your tank was hit.
Oh, yeah.
Explain that to me. Take me through that.
We're slowly going down the road. I was sitting in the, Jim Gall was the rider, the driver. Busting through the jungle. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, I was out cold. And then I remember them dragging me to this riverbank, and dust off came in, and I kind of woke up on the helicopter.
Now, what hit your tank? Was it
a mine?
It was a mine.
Yeah.
Okay, a VC mine had hit your tank. Where did it hit the tank?
Underneath.
Okay, and where were you?
In the drive, as they call it, the commander's seat.
The commander's seat.
Yeah.
All right, when this thing went off, where, number one, where did it hit you and what hit you?
In the body, let's see, my eyes and a little shrapnel.
Just, you say a little shrapnel.
Yeah.
Can you give me more specifics on that?
Well, my flak vest took most of it. And a little in the ass, one in the neck, a bloody nose, and I couldn't see.
Who else was in the tank with you at the time?
Let's see, there were Means and two gunners. Let's see, one, two, three, four in the turret, but infantry guys on the back riding with us. And a driver and myself, probably about 10 people.
10 people. How badly were the rest of them hurt?
Means got evacuated, the sergeant. And I think one infantry kid was killed. And that was it. I remember Means and I were on the helicopter.
So the mine hit your tank, and obviously it must have been very, very chaotic.
Oh, yeah.
Confusion.
Yep.
May not even had time to have been afraid.
Remember, and when I was in the hospital, I had, soiled myself, and there was blood all over the place.
So you've been hit, or were you badly enough injured that you couldn't get out of the tank by yourself?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I must have crawled out.
Okay. You find yourself, I guess you said you woke up.
Yep.
Did you wake up in the helicopter?
No, right on the bank, because I remember the dust-off pilot yelling to Eli. Eli told him, because of our training, he said, I threw purple smoke. And I remember on the radio, the pilot saying, no, I'll tell you what color smoke.
Right. Yeah. Just to keep the VC in case they're listening.
Oh, yeah, because they were shooting and all.
Sure. So you're laying there on the bank. Was it a river, creek?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was like a river. Okay. Knowing what I know now, it was probably the Song Mi River when I did a little research and try to do some stuff. But, yeah.
Do you remember what's going through your mind while you're laying on the bank?
Oh, yeah.
Explain.
Oh, God, get me to the hospital.
How long were you there before dust off?
Right. I don't know. Probably 20 minutes.
Did it seem like 20 minutes?
I honestly don't know, Kyle, to tell you the exact. I don't know.
Sure. So you do remember the pilot, the dust-off pilot?
Yep.
Speaking to you.
I remember him on the radio saying to Eli, mm-hmm. No, I'll tell you the color of smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But he came right in, I remember that. I saw it coming in. And then they put me on a helicopter, and then I think it was Lockheed or some hospital out there.
Who put you on a helicopter, do you remember?
Eli and Jan Gall, the driver of the tank that blew up.
Okay. So you're medevaced out. And where again did you say you received treatment?
I think. I'm not sure. But I believe it was Lockheed. L-A-I and then K-H-E, I think. I'm not sure.
Okay. What kind of treatment did you receive there?
Love this. The medic that attended to me, I went to high school with.
Really?
Yeah.
What was his name?
Joe Giordano.
Was in the same class as you?
Yeah. Well,
that's kind of a strange coincidence, I would tell you.
I remember him saying, Billy, you're all right, you're all right, don't worry about it. You're going to, he says, what a way to earn a Purple Heart. And I said, hey, can I see? That's all, because I couldn't see for a while.
Sure.
He says, don't worry, you're all right. I remember the bright lights on the, whether it was an operating table or whatever,
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I stayed 2 days there.
What do you think of the treatment you received there?
Excellent, without a doubt.
You were there just 2 days then?
Yep.
Okay.
I wanted out of there.
And then you went back out. Why did you want out so badly?
I wanted to go back to where I came from. I wanted to be with everybody else, show them I was okay,
Sure. So although certainly a frightening experience, it doesn't sound like the wounds were bad enough to incapacitate you for a very long time.
No, not at all. I had a patch, big deal. A gauze bandage over my eyes and, band-aids in my legs and ass and one on my neck.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a couple of stitches. I don't remember.
Sure. Well, you make it back to your unit a few days later.
Uh-huh.
What's the reception you received?
Oh, open. Well, when I was in the hospital, Lieutenant Rowe and the captain came to visit me anyway.
That must have made you feel pretty good, I would think.
Oh, yeah. I always told you, those two offices, I held the highest respect in my life for those men.
What about the rest of the men when you came back?
Oh,
glad to
they
see
were
you?
All glad, you know. You know, the typical, you know, you asshole, I knew you couldn't die, you know, oh, you're lucky, all this, you know.
Sure, sure.
Stuff like that.
The way that males relate to one another in situations like that.
Yeah, you know, you laugh at everything, and, you know, you try to make a joke of it.
Sure. Now, this being hit like this, it must have seemed incredibly random.
Yeah.
For you. Did this, what did this do to you for the rest of your tour there? Was this something that you saw as, now this could happen to me at any time?
Oh,
was
yeah.
Was this a totally random thing that...
I think it woke all of us up. But, see, before... I don't know if I want to say this is good or bad, but when I told you we were test firing the weapons and we had to pull those four kids eventually out of the tank that turned over, that exposed us all. Hey, this is for real. Now it got more personalized with them trying to, you know, trying to blow my ass up.
Sure, sure. Well, what, if anything, did you or your unit do in for the remainder of Cedar Falls?
We went back, I know, when it was over, and then we went back 2 days later, we went right out to Junction City.
Okay. Did your unit change its tactics or its approach or anything as a result
no,
of the mine
explosion? No, because
everything
we were doing was new to us anyway.
Sure. Okay.
And we went back to, you know, we just watch them burn villages, evacuate Vietnamese people, and stand guard for that, you know, blow up the jungle or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And do convoys and back and forth to help supplies come back. And whatever the mission was, it was basically either support a poor infantry unit out there. I remember I was exposed to my first B-52 bomb, and that was an experience and a half.
Explain that to me.
Captain said, everybody in your holds. We says, wow, we were in, I want to say it was some base camp or a fire base somewhere out there. And again, I ran into a kid that I was in basic with, Joe Coyle. And he was the poor infantry kid from the 1st Infantry. And I hear somebody yelling my name. And, you know, we shot the shoot with them for a couple of hours. But it was when he said, in the holds, I remember Joe saying, get in them. So we get in them, and the earth shook for like, 10 minutes. I've never been in an earthquake or anything, but people that have said that was it. It was awful.
How many B-52s made this run?
I don't know. I have no idea. But I remember in the holes, and we dove. Thank God the infantry had already dug holes, and we were in their holes with them. And then when somebody blows an air horn, you jump back on in the back in the tank, and you start firing away.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the purpose of these particular B-52 raids?
I don't know. I don't know, Kyle, to be honest. I guess they were hitting a stronghold or something that we were near. I know it was near some rubber plantation. That was it.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that your participation in Cedar Falls, and mostly it's support of infantry units and things like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, Junction City is somewhat of a follow-up, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it's a exact follow-up.
February 67.
Cedar Falls was a harbinger or a decoy for... You know, in the little reading that I've done on it, I believe Cedar Falls was a lead-up to Junction City because more infantry battalions, I think they took in the 1st, the 25th, the 196th. It was on a more major, on Westmoreland's lovely plans of whatever they were.
Okay, well, to you at the time, what did you know about the purpose of Junction City?
Nothing real. What, you know, you're going out and basically you're doing your duty to, I hate to say it, but, to, you know, kill or capture an enemy.
Sure. Were you able to do that? Or do you know?
I guess so.
Okay.
I guess so.
You say you guess so, and I understand that it is
I didn't have
completely
to do
chaotic.
Body counts, no.
Sure.
But put it this way, there were dead bodies out there.
Sure, sure. Now, were you doing any of the firing?
Oh, yeah.
In your tank?
Actually, I was doing the loading.
Loading at this point.
Because, knock on wood, the tanks weren't acting up yet.
Okay. So the tanks did eventually begin to act up, and this is during Junction City.
Yeah, especially with vapor locking and transmissions because they weren't used to pulling that heavy load.
Okay. Can you give me any more specifics on that? you're there to fix tanks, and the tanks start to give you problems there.
Yep.
At a very critical point in early 1967.
Right.
How does that change what you're doing?
Geez, Kyle, it changes due to the adverse effects of when you're changing them and where you're changing them. You know, my notion of staying back in a base camp was washed away immediately when I got to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sitting in some comfy place just fixing tanks and trucks. You had to be out there with them, because if they threw a track, the poor crew didn't know what to do, so you had to go out and do it. I can remember changing an engine down the Delta in the middle of a firefight, you know. But you just, how did it change me? I guess the conditions changed me. You knew you were under fire. That was it.
All right. So Junction City...
Mm-hmm.
Was this the last major operations you participated in?
At that time, yeah.
Okay.
Because then we transferred down to the Delta.
You went down with 4 Corps, I guess, in the Delta. What sort of operations were you involved with down there?
Well, number one was to help the 9th Infantry establish a base.
The Arvin 9th Infantry?
No, thank God. No, the American 9th
Infantry. Oh, okay. I know the 9th Arvin Division was down there in 4
Corps.
Yeah,
yes, they were...
Okay. Well, you sound like you have
I have no respect for them except for Vietnamese Rangers. Every time there was a fight, you know, you go down to a town and you'd see all these clowns hanging around, but whenever there was a fight, they were nowhere to be found. I don't mean by a fist fight either.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly not the only person to express that opinion of the Arvin and their fighting effectiveness here. How much contact did you have with the Arvin?
We had to bail them out a couple of times down in the Delta when they get overrun, or would have to move, you know, quickly to give them gun support when there was no helicopters. If they were within a 20-mile radius of Dong Tam, we'd have to go out and rescue them.
Okay. And when you say rescue them, how would you do it? Take me on a...
Get down there and start firing away and clean out what was ever down there.
Okay. And, of course, this was a VC, probably exclusively.
I believe so. No more pith helmets were found down in the Delta. I don't think in Junction City and Cedar Falls, I'd give you a maybe, but down the Delta, I doubt there were any hardcores. I don't think.
Sure. What else were you doing down here?
Okay, we do a lot of village securing, a lot of bridge securing, a lot of convoy running, and actually we lived in Tan An. We... Best duty I ever had was guarding Air America. They had a little, how can we say it, a shady airport. So we just had us and the 9th Infantry, poor infantry guys. We had to support their base. That was a nice duty.
Well, explain that to me. What made it so nice?
The food, number one.
What kind of food were you getting there?
What were we getting there? Steaks. Regular cooked meals, regular Thai food that when they come back. And unload their little Piper Cubs, and whatever came out was food for the boys, food and booze for the boys.
That must have felt pretty good.
Yeah, that was, like I said, for two. Rigney, God bless him, he got stuck there for months, God bless him. But because they left 2 tanks down there, and we flipped and I lost. But no, that was, that was good duty. That was excellent duty.
What sort of interaction did you have with the U.S. Knight?
Right, they were, believe it or not, now we had been there for, 5 months, so we were experienced. These poor guys, I really felt bad for them. They were on boats fighting a war, believe it or not. They'd get on boats, and we'd have to load these big tanks on barges and go down and help them out when their artillery couldn't come. Or if they would take over a village, we'd surround the village. And these poor kids, they were worse. They were very poorly trained, I thought.
Where'd they come from?
Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Okay. All right. You mentioned that you were securing villages, bridges, et cetera.
Yep.
Was your outfit involved in any civil action?
No. Not civil actions, but naturally, if they were building something, Nancy would provide support for them. You'd play with the little kids.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally. You know, if an infantry medic would go into a village, we'd would just go there and, you know, provide security for them.
Okay. Now, so this is, what month would this have been?
It had to be from April till I left. We were down in the Delta.
Okay. So that's, most of your time was spent down in the Delta then.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like.
Baptism by fire, I called the first one, and it was a little better down the Delta.
All right. What were you doing when you weren't on a mission? What were you doing back at base?
We weren't back in base that much. We stayed out. We lived in a village for a whole month.
Which village was it?
Pardon me?
Which village was it?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Okay.
Tan something or other.
All right, all right.
I'm sorry, I don't know which village it was. It was, you know, and something or other. I have no idea.
Sure, sure. Well, when you did have time off, when you weren't on a mission, when you weren't...
back at base camp, pull the tanks back in and do the preventive maintenance. And luckily enough, I didn't have to go out on guard duty at night, you know, whatever base camp you were in. So listen to the Rolling Stones, smoke cigarettes. That's it.
Did you have any contact with your friends or family back home?
Oh, yeah. One we had. Oh, the mail was good. Don't forget, back in those, in my early times over there, in the late 66 and early 67, we were even getting letters from the Medford, Massachusetts kids in school. Oh, yeah, America was, quote, Medford was still behind their troops. You know, you get little letters from kids and all that.
What'd that do for you?
I thought it was great. And naturally, the letters from my then girlfriend, but now my wife. And those, you know, those do wonders. Naturally, mail does wonders.
Did you write back?
Oh, yeah.
About how often?
I tried to write, even though it wouldn't get mailed for days, I tried to write something every day.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Just to friends, family, girlfriends,
mostly
things like
to
that.
Patsy, mostly to my wife and my mother.
All right.
I know she was, as my friend did. My friend did write me once a week. You know, you idiot, you know, how many did you kill today? You know, stuff like that. Keep your head down. Don't get wounded anymore. You know, stuff like that. Who was going out with who? Who was getting laid? You know, stuff like that.
Sure. What was the morale of the unit in general, you in particular at this time?
I think our unit, believe it or not, I think it was excellent. I have to say, well, you got a new captain, but he never came out visit us but once. But I would say amongst the draftees, anybody that was drafted, it was excellent. It was an excellent bonding factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody took care of everybody else.
You get any R&R while you were there?
Yes, I got a week, Easter week. Rigney and I went to Tokyo.
What did you do in Tokyo?
First thing I did is I went to church and said, thank God.
Okay.
And after that, ate and drank. That was it. And took a bath the first night. I remember Easter, I called Patsy up and told her it was a riot because Rigney and I, the bathtub had this nasty, nasty brown reek because we took a bath instead of a shower, and it had that lovely-ass, red-ass clay in it. That's what I remember.
What was it like going from Tokyo, which must have seemed like heaven at the time, to going back to your unit? Were you in a hurry to go back, or was it...
Oh, no, no. You didn't... Actually, I wanted to go to Australia, but, you know, that was, you know, for officers and above. Mm-hmm. And naturally, you couldn't go to Hawaii because you had to be married. But so we went to, you know, I didn't want to go to an Asian country, but, hey, captain said, you two are going. All right, we're going. And it was all right, you know. Nothing special. It was a vacation like anything else.
Sure.
Took the bullet train, went up and saw Mount Fujiyama, you know, bought the stupid presents for everybody, you know, the jackets for my little brother, you know, knickknacks for my mother, stuff like that.
Sure. Now, this is what, April, I guess, of 67?
Yeah.
Now, you still have quite a bit of time left in country.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing when you got back? I guess you were going back to the Delta.
What were we doing?
Just the same type of missions, support, et cetera.
Yeah, same type of missions. It's just in a different location, very flat, very wet.
Okay. Now, what did you think of the enemy you were facing? What was your opinion of the VC that you encountered?
It had changed, believe it or not. I mean, this is one... I still didn't understand why one human wanted to kill another, and to this day I don't. But my outlook on life, you don't bother me, I don't bother you.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to say I maintained that in Vietnam. You bothered me, I'm going to bother you back.
What were your initial expectations of the VC?
Oh, a screaming maniac doing charges and, you know, no regard for life and you know, no respect for life, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Did that make it emotionally easier or more difficult to engage them?
By April, I was, I don't want to say hardened, but I could care less. I just wanted to get home.
Sure, sure. Had your impression of the VC, your evaluation of the VC, changed from your initial expectations to later on? Explain how that changed and what that
it
meant.
It changed, I believe it really changed, first when the tank flipped over. This is the incident before we went out on, before I got wounded. And then when I got wounded, I said, hey, some fucker's, pardon me, some person's trying to kill me. Mm-hmm. But I think from that point on, they weren't a person. They were, quote, an enemy then.
Sure.
And you just had to be wary of every your surroundings, totally, totally, totally aware of your surroundings. And you couldn't give, don't give anybody a break, you know, just get my mine and my friends the hell out of here.
Now, like you say, you had to be on guard.
Yes.
Constantly.
Yes, constant.
Constantly on guard because of the VC.
Right.
Now, of course, as we know, the VC were very, very difficult to pick
very
out.
Very elusive, yes.
Yes, certainly in villages.
Uh-huh.
One you may pass and not know it.
Mm-hmm.
What did this make your relationship like with the villagers that you encountered, with the rest of the native Vietnamese?
Well, you know, Kyle, it's funny because mostly in a village it would be women and children, not too many men. Old men you'd see, but you wouldn't see anybody from, say, 15 to 40. You may see him out in the field tilling his crops or whatever, but you'd never interact with a person that age. Never.
Okay. Was it easy or difficult to separate your opinion or your understanding, evaluation of villagers versus VC? Was this something that you said you're all potentially VC and therefore you're all potentially an enemy that I'm going to have to deal with immediately if necessary?
After I was wounded, yes, everybody was an enemy.
Okay.
I hate to say it, but yes, everybody was an enemy. I'd say, man, who the hell's trying to kill me now? You know, but then you'd see him picking garbage dumps, and you'd say, how could this be an enemy? But then you'd say, listen, idiot, you got blown up. Somebody had to do it, you know?
Right, right. What is your evaluation of the VC as an enemy?
I thought he was a damn good enemy, if there's such a thing. This man was dedicated. This man was defending his own. He was defending his country like I'd defend mine, probably, if somebody was coming after me.
What did you think was most effective about the VC?
What was the most effectiveness?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
What were their greatest strengths, do you think?
They were dedicated. Very dedicated to a purpose. And they were excellent. You could never get them.
Mm-hmm.
They were a professional soldier, I guess, with limited means. But with those limited means, they knew what they were doing.
It must have been incredibly frustrating, I would think, to be so, you know, in every measurable way, militarily superior to such an enemy.
Very, 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 very. Yes, once you get into that, like I say, once you get into that military move, you say, where is this man going? Or where is this person going? He just mortared us. He just shot at us, and we can't find him.
Oftentimes, I think that this would lead to, this frustration would lead to striking out against anyone who is seemingly an enemy.
That crossed our minds, but luckily, no.
Okay.
No, once... how can I say this properly? Once we were in I won't say we wrecked it, but we did a number on a bar in downtown Dong Tam, which was outside of Mai Tho. That was where the ninth were, and we could go into the village, so we went in, and it was somebody said something, and boom, all of a sudden a bar got wrecked. But as far as physical damage, I mean, as human damage, nah.
All right.
Yeah, we didn't, thank God there was no... oh, what the hell, where was Callie and his crew there? No, that didn't hit our battalion. You know, we had the fire, you had to take out a village or a hut, you know. We just did it. We hoped that there had been enough warning before we fired in there, but once somebody's firing at you, you just fire back.
Sure, sure.
But as far as retaliating against an enemy due to frustration, thank God, no. The idea had crossed our minds, don't get me wrong. But no, we never did it.
All right, well, you've given me your impression of the enemy and their abilities and their strengths. Uh-huh. What about your own leadership?
Okay.
What about the American leadership?
Captain Stein, am I supposed to mention names or what?
It's completely up to you.
Captain Steinbacher and Lieutenant Rowe, I cherish the men. They were excellent. You know, Rowe even showed me how to get out. In fact, he recommended. Steinbacher was a dedicated man, but we lost him when we went down the Delta.
You say you lost him. Was he killed?
Pardon me?
Was he killed? Or
no,
did
no, no.
Transfer
he
out?
Major.
Okay.
And that's where his career ended. And he was promoted, and he went. We got a Captain Hollis, who we saw once. From what my buddies tell me, he never came out of his bunker. First Sergeant was a complete asshole, little runt. Most of the E6s, they knew we were running it, so they let us do what we want. And then there was a few like Sergeant Perrault. He was excellent, old man, getting ready to go out, and we just protected his ass whenever they sent him out with us. But it was, how can I say it? It was a sergeant's war with us. That say, take two tanks, go here. And Lieutenant Siegel, he was okay, but he just let us do what we want to do. Then when we went down to the Delta, it was a little different when we were with big operations with the 1st Infantry and the 11th Army. You know, you were more structured. Here, down the Delta, we were, quote, experienced, unquote. And, you know, they let us do what we did what we wanted to do. You know, because a 9th Infantry captain or something would come up and say, I need two tanks. So Siegel would look at us, yeah, we'll go today. We'll do this. And the E6s, they would never leave base camp either. They'd find an excuse not to go on the camp.
So it sounds like it's kind of a mixed bag for you.
Many
individuals.
Most all the draftees, they were kids like me, just like me. You know, maybe I was a little more, I don't want to say educated, and came from a little better family background, but a lot of the kids were like from Alabama and Mississippi, and they were doing what they had to do, and then they were going to go back to what they were doing. They just wanted to get out alive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were lucky in that aspect. We only lost a few people.
Now, you'd mentioned before that you had very little contact with racial minorities.
Right.
Growing up in New England.
Mm-hmm.
Was this the case? I gather that it wasn't.
Oh, no.
In your
we
battalion
were about. Actually, we were about. Oh, somebody asked me this before. I would say 70% white, 20% black, and 10% Hispanic.
Okay.
Except for most of your NCOs now, a lot of them were black,
mm-hmm.
African-American.
Sure, sure. Now, that leads me to this next question, which begs to be asked. At this time, in 1966, 1967, did you witness any episodes of racial unrest or
nope.
Problems? Not at this time.
Heard of them, but nope, we never had them.
Okay, you heard of them.
Oh,
did
yeah.
You hear of them more prevalently in the rear or in combat units?
Mostly in the rear.
Okay.
And you know, when you talk to the kids in the 9th Infantry, you know, when we would be doing nothing, them poor bastards, we have to go to formations. You know, they were in the chicken shit army.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these poor kids, after they come out for, say, 3 days of fighting, or whatever, and then they'd have to get back and fall out in formation with boots, and then they'd see us just laying around there drinking beers, fixing our tanks, because nobody ever really bothered us.
Sure, sure. Well, when do you receive your orders to leave Vietnam?
Ah, that was a good one. In May, Lieutenant Rowe came to me and says, Billy, you don't belong here. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're going back to school. I says, nah, I don't want to go back. I got no desire to go to school. He says, I'm telling you, write your buddies, tell them to get you in any college in the world, go to a community college, do anything. So as a joke, I sent off a letter. In June, Lieutenant Rowe flew in and said, I just signed something. I said, what? He says, you're going home in August. I said, what? He said, just shut up, keep your mouth shut. I'll just buy this get it by the captain and the first sergeant, but you've been approved for college. I says, where am I going? Because my buddies had told me they put me, where the hell was it? North Shore Community College. And they accepted me with open arms and all that, so I knew I was going home at the end of August.
Why did this lieutenant pick you out?
Basically, he liked me, and he knew I... He just said, you don't belong here. You've done what you had to do, you know. As a matter of fact, I think he says, hey, you're not losing your life over here under me. So, you know, God bless him. I wish I could run into the man again.
Yeah, that must have created and even a all pretty the strong other, bond between
even the guys in the, you know, like Rigney and all my buddies that were down at Delta, even Lieutenant Siegel, who is assigned to us down at Delta. They said, smart move. We should have done the same thing, but a lot of the kids, I'll never forget Eli. He said, you son of a bitch. He says, yeah, the only way you're getting out of here is your brains, and God bless you. I wish I could go. He was saying he wished he could remember how to spell Mississippi so he could get back to college. But, you know, that was, I lucked out. I found a man that liked me.
Sure sounds like it.
Yeah, and to this day, I mean, I wish I had. I only did 3 years of college, but hey, you know, I just couldn't finish it. But hey, you know, it's, I owe my life to the man because two of my buddies got killed just before they come home. They were doing something that they shouldn't have done, but I don't think that would have happened if I was there. But actually, I'll brag a little. I took care of a lot of people, too. You know, if I knew one tank wasn't ready to go out and these kids were scared, I knew how to freeze up an engine for an hour, you know?
Sure.
And Bro knew this, and some of the people knew this, but, you know, you just talk to the kid, say, here, go to sick call, tell him you're nervous or something, but I'll make sure your tank isn't running. And we'd make sure that the other tank would cover for them, you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
Little tricks. They knew what was going on, but they wouldn't, you know, do it. Or if we thought a mission sucked, we could screw the tanks up easy.
So
which was good.
You mentioned that you had two friends killed in an incident. Is this something you care to talk about or no?
Not really. What they did is they stole Siegel's Jeep, and they were going to make a trip to Saigon, and they got killed on the way back because the assholes, they left at 6 at night, and they got ambushed on a road. I found that out when I was in college, you know, because the boys were still writing to me.
Sure.
But 4 days before they go home, they wanted to get laid in Saigon, the fools. And they get jumped and they get killed.
Wow.
Yeah. Wonderful.
What's it like for you to leave these men?
Terrible. Terrible.
What did you do?
Oh, I felt so guilty, but they all said, get out of here. Go. You know, we're coming home in 2 more months anyway. You know, and by then we were pretty, you know, we were quote seasoned veterans, you know. Oh, it was a big joke. The one thing I had to say, though, the son of a bitch captain and First Sergeant put me out on patrol the last night.
It's your last night in country, they put you on patrol.
Yep. That's all right. I crossed the Lieutenant Rowe again, came to my aid. He is just going to make captain. And he happened to be the officer of the day in this big complex. We must have wasted $1 million worth of ammunition. I saw movement out there.
So the lieutenant went with you?
Yeah, no, he was the officer of the day, so we're calling for permission to fire.
Oh, okay.
And he says, who's this? And I says, I'll never forget it, Devastate Charlie 8 Alpha. He says, definitely. He called in Spookies, he called in everything. There was nothing there. But, and the captain, and I saluted him, and the first sergeant, he says, Cameron, we knew you did it. I says, well, did you get your fucking ass out of the bunker? You know? No, I'll never forget that as long as I live. And it was Bearcat. That was where our headquarters, I guess, had been moved to. I had never been there. But you had the process out there, so. But, oh, there was almost a riot when they sent me out on patrol.
Of your friends?
Oh, they were going to refuse to go. I said, what's going to happen? I said, I'll show you what. Oh, man. And all the kids in there, I think it was in 9th Infantry Headquarters, too. They were all saying, yeah, because it kept them up all night. You knew no VC were getting anywhere near the place. They never came near the place anyway. We were mortared once, I guess, there. But no, it cost the U.S. government lots of money that night.
Why do you think the captain sent you out?
Because he was an asshole. He was pissed that I was... I don't know. you know, I think they were pissed because I was going to college.
Mm-hmm.
I was a draftee, you know, and I still had my, I won't say better than thou attitude, but I was going home.
Sure.
See you later, you know. He was a real pisser with his shiny little cowboy boots. And then a little weasel first sergeant, he just smiled. I says, well, I hope you get to be the youngest first sergeant in the Army, but I says, I'm out of here. And they would, you know, as my buddies were writing when I was home, I would laugh. They'd say, you wouldn't believe they're still talking about that first night, that last night that you left, and oh, yeah. And how, you know, the captain to this day, nobody else is going to college. Well, two other kids went to college. I loved it.
That must have frosted him.
Oh, it frosted his ass.
Well, when did you leave Vietnam?
When? October, no, August. I don't know, I should remember the date, like the back of my hand. Let's see, was it 10 months, 11? I don't know. I want to say August sometime. August of 67.
That sounds right, given the other dates that you had there. So you're headed back across the pond.
Yep.
And you've already been accepted to, was it North Shore, you say, Community College?
North Shore Community College,
okay.
Yep.
What did you hope to do once you got home? What's the first thing you wanted to do?
First thing I want to do is see my parents.
Okay. Can you describe that meeting for me?
Well, my father had to almost stop me from getting arrested because at Logan Airport, there was a second lieutenant that demanded I salute him in the airport, and I told him to go fuck himself. He was screaming, and I was screaming, and my father just come over today. The kid just get back from Vietnam. Leave him alone. That doesn't give him any right. I said, fuck you. You know, all he had on was a National Defense Medal, so I knew he hadn't been over there. You know?
Right.
But the creep wanted me to salute him. And then, I hugged my father. He and I stopped. He said, you're finally 21. We stopped for a beer at Mike's Cafe in Malden, and then I went home and saw my family. And it was tearful, but that was it. You know, your brothers and sisters, how many did you kill? Your mother and father, just happy you're home, you know?
Sure, sure.
Stuff like that.
How did the community greet you?
I didn't have any problems. I had no problems.
I
got rid of the uniform as soon as I got home, and I never put it on again. But
now, you were completely out at this time.
Well, yeah, they say you had to go in the reserves and all that.
Right.
I didn't have to.
Oh, is that right? You didn't even have to do reserve time then?
No, okay. I didn't do shit.
Okay.
I was in school.
Okay,
then
very
I got
good.
Married.
All right. Well, so many Vietnam veterans report receiving just disgraceful, shameful treatment by so many American
people. Horrid. No, I didn't, except for that one incident with the... I saw the protesters at Oakland and San Francisco when I was flying out, but I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't bother me. I didn't bother them. And then, these kids, talking to some kid like Rigney in Louisville, got in literally a brawl at a bar in there, and Bovard in California, a couple of my buddies, you know, they got arrested because something was saying about it. Nah, I didn't, you know, I could care less. That was, shut the book on that chapter of my life.
Okay.
So I thought.
Well, let's look at it like this. You're home in the fall of 1967.
Yep.
And, of course, this war continues for an awful lot longer.
Oh,
it becomes much more intense.
Long.
The public outcry against the war becomes much more intense. It really becomes an absolute mess,
right,
for lack of a better term. Are you following this very closely?
Oh, yeah. Especially until October, and then the following year when my best friend got drafted and killed. Oh, yeah, I really got changed then.
So how did that change you?
Oh, I war sucks. You know, when Spring and Gassman got killed, that really set me on a loop. And then my buddy, who had just graduated from Northeastern with a degree in engineering,
mm-hmm.
he was an only son, didn't have to go. But he says, nah, you went, I'm going. I said, nah, bullshit, you don't have to go, don't go. He wouldn't listen to me.
Why do you want to go so badly?
He just figured it was his duty, you know?
Okay.
It was an only son. Here he is, a civil engineer with a degree, and they put him in the fucking 196th Infantry as a ground pounder. And naturally, the kid got killed on my wedding anniversary. Oh, yeah, it was just lovely.
Wow.
So you can see my love for the Army now.
Sure, sure.
But I'll tell you, it changed in October when I knew they were all out safe. I was still hurt. And what happened is, when I skated through, that year at North Shore. It was a joke. It was my sophomore year. I skated, but their death just croaked me. And then I went off and then I finally married Patsy, and then later I went back to BC, but I never finished.
Mm-hmm.
I should have, but I didn't. Shame on me.
What about the protests of the war? Was it something mm-hmm. that you could embrace or something you were opposed to, given your experiences in Vietnam and knowing what was going on there from your perspective?
Yeah.
How did you interpret this growing outcry against the war?
On one hand, they had a right to protest. That was no problem. You know, go against LBJ, go against Nixon. I could care less. You know, say all you want. But once you start spitting on people and dishonoring them, then I actually got in confrontations and said, what is this? And I'll be honest, I couldn't look at Asian people too beneficially.
So has that changed over the years?
About 2 years ago, I started to mellow. But then with Iraq and Iran, I just went nuts again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those poor kids, you know. And none of them are drafted. That's why I feel bad for them.
Sure. Well, you've made it home safe and sound. You got married. When did
mm-hmm.
you get married?
Had three wonderful children who now they give me grandchildren. So, and Patsy stayed with me all these years, and I retired and got cancer. So, it hasn't been too bad.
When did you get married?
When?
When?
69.
1969.
Yep.
And you said you had how many children again?
Three.
Three children. How many grandchildren?
Three.
Three. One
yeah,
from
and
each?
Hopefully there's two more on the way.
Terrific.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Now, you say that you have cancer now.
Yep.
Do you think this was...
I know it is. I went to, and I see I got 100%. Well, it's not permanent, but I have two forms of cancer. I lost the kidney, and that was under Agent Orange, and I also come down with a lymphoma. It was also Agent Orange related.
Mm-hmm.
So I filed a claim. And that was, you know, that was my last, you know, thank you from Vietnam. Because the one cancer I had, I could blame the kidney on smoking, maybe. But it's called a Waldenstrom's macroglobulinema. I know, it's a rare, rare cancer, like 1 in 2 million get it. But they say, yep, that's directly related to Agent Orange.
I could only imagine that this would increase your frustration with your, not necessarily all of your experiences, but many of your experiences in the war of having to go. How else do you think the war has affected you personally?
Well, I respect life like there's no tomorrow. You live every day to its fullest extent.
Mm-hmm.
You try to be nice to people. And if it isn't an earth-shattering experience, if it is life and death, you know, don't let it bother you.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely how I try to lead my life. And everybody has a choice in life, you know. Stay within the bounds of the law, and I respect that.
What do you think you learned about yourself most as a result of your experiences there?
Ooh, wow. Myself, as long as you have good people around you, you're safe. As long as you have good people, whether it be the military, my wife, my children, my friends, as long as they support you, and they're true believers in you, you're all right. You'll make it. You'll be okay.
Do you participate with any veterans organizations, any reunions or anything like that?
I went to one reunion back in 89 of the Dusters, and
mm-hmm.
I lasted one day there. You know, they all wanted to fight the war again. I said, see you later. It was in Indianapolis, and I flew right back home.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Sure, I hear that a lot from a number of individuals
mm-hmm.
who prefer to just to not necessarily forget it, but to leave it behind as
right.
something that's passed.
You know, it's over. You know. And when Brigney, my buddy, died of cancer last year, you know, that was. I still have two people. David Bovard and Larry Bratton. I still converse with them about five times a year.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, That's my ties to the war. And naturally, I visit Michael's grave. There's two of my friends. One died before I went, and one died after. I still go up to visit their graves about once a month.
Have you ever made it to Washington, D.C. to visit the wall?
Yeah, and to the wall. That was a very moving experience. I took my youngest son at the time. He was, how old was Sean then? 12 or 13.
What did that mean to you?
It was great because Sean, actually, the hot ass that I am, brings up a little tear. He says, Dad, you can cry. Don't worry about it. You deserved it. And it was a 12, 13-year-old kid.
You know? That must have been very moving, I would think, for you.
Yes, it was. And then I visited it twice. And then with the job I had, too, with the federal government, I'd have to go to Washington like once a month, and I'd make my compulsory pit stop over there to see my buddies that died over there and then see my couple of friends, see their names on the wall.
Sure. What did you do?
Just go to visit the Korean Memorial. And, go about my business.
Yeah, the Korean Memorial is also very moving in a different way. It's haunting,
yes,
it seems to me.
Yes, thank you, especially when there's a fog out and there's a drizzle. Oh, you could put that anywhere.
Yeah, my first trip to D.C., my wife and I saw it during the middle of a drizzle.
Yeah.
And it was just incredible.
Yeah, I have a lovely neighbor that lives next door. He's lived next to me for 20 years. He still refuses to go see it. He's got all kinds of medals. He's a real nice old guy. You know, he tells me stories, and, I listen to him when we go out for coffee. But Jack is, he's excellent.
What job did you take with the federal government?
Well, that was Homeland Security. That was my last one that when I got the cancer I had. But I worked for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, believe it or not, in the prisons. And I was the warden of a prison. And I retired after 25 years. I lasted for a year with no retirement. And I went to work for Homeland Security until I got sick.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking at the Vietnam War, in a larger sense, what do you think it was about for the United States? Why do you think the United States was involved, and why do you think that it evolved the way that it did?
Kyle, do you want my recollections as a 20-year-old or as a 62-year-old man?
Either one, or both.
As a 62-year-old man, it was nothing more than a civil war. They had no business being there. I don't know if there was any oil involved, but I'm willing to bet there's some underlying subject. They had to defend, without boring you, they had. I didn't want to go in with the French, but he gave them all the money they wanted. Kennedy got caught. He just had to go, and then LBJ didn't know why, but he still went, and he faked up that Gulf of Tonkin incident. And as an 19-year-old kid, it was something I had to do because I was brought up in the Kennedy era. Plain and simple. You just trusted everybody. You trust what they say, and you do it for God, country, and the church. But now, as you look back and you mature, I won't say it was immoral, but if there's a word just below immoral, I'd say yeah. Yeah. And that's it.
What lessons do you think that we should take from the Vietnam War?
Well, we took them, but we're not practicing them. Stay the fuck out, plain and simple, unless you're invaded. I'm sorry I get carried away on it, but there's no reason they should be. If you're in Iraq, you go in, you do your business, you get out there, don't lollygag around and lie to me and say it's for, you're looking for Obama or this, materials that he could blow the world up with. That's harsh shit. Tell the truth, but you won't get it. After this is over, the next generation, they'll be in a war, probably in Darfur or Nigeria or something like that. We never learn. I mean, here's what's getting back. Now I'm on my soapbox, but forgive me.
No, that's fine. Please.
But, they didn't. Here's Westmoreland fighting World War II tactics because he completely forgets about Korea. And he's, he's trying to stomp out all these massive weapons, and he's trying to stomp out some poor country that all they wanted to do was vote. And the Americans pulled out in that vote in 54, and Ho Chi Minh made all his... I wish I knew this when I was 18. I probably still would have went, because Canada is not an option. I like living in stone here. But it's all lies, and why do people have to lie? know. That's my soapbox. I'm sorry.
No. That's perfectly fine, for sure. And the question I should have mentioned or brought up earlier, given the support and almost the adoration you had as a young man for Kennedy, and you talk about this, you know, the skepticism that you have now.
Isn't it awful? Isn't it awful? My youth was destroyed. It sucks, well, but, you know, basically that's why I'm glad. I asked my two sons. I know this is off the charts. Now, Billy, who's my oldest, I said, would you have gone? He said, yeah. I said to Sean, would you have gone? He says, no. And I said to both of them, I still love you the same. Mm-hmm. And I'd support both of your methods. I tried to talk Billy out of it, but nothing. If he wanted to go to Canada or wherever, I'd support him.
Sure.
You know, because I could see the mother. Poor Patsy was in shock when Billy said he'd go. And the reason he said, my father went, I got to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I went, you know. But with Sean, God bless him, my youngest one said, nah, I'm not going. This is bullshit. And he's right. You know, then Ford pardoned them all, so good luck to him, you know.
Right. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to end this interview, Bill. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we put a close on this?
No, I just wish everybody thought the way I thought, but that's the way, you know, for future generations. But it won't happen. That's my cynicism showing. But, you know, I appreciate what you people are doing.
All right, well.
Anything else I can do, just give me a yell.
I really appreciate it. I want to ask you to hang on for just a moment. I want to turn off the recording equipment.
Sure.
And I'll chat with you for a moment afterwards. This ends the interview with William Cameron.